Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Join us on our journey into the past, the present, and the future as we explore the relationship between technology and humanity. Together, we're going to find out what it means to live in a society where everything is connected and the only constant is change. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Ready? Recording is on.
This is it.
Story time.
It is story time, and we have a collection of unusual backgrounds for this unusual gathering. Webcast edition, right? These are always on video, which is very cool. And we're all faced with different threats every day, and we probably, most of us don't even realize it.
I have no idea. I just walk through life like...
We just get in the shower, we make our coffee, we eat our breakfast, we connect to Zoom and have conversations with our friends. And we go through life not knowing what's really going on around us many times. And that might work for most of us in life, but not always a good idea for business. And I think we're going to talk
software.
About... Or software that runs the business, and I think we're going to talk all about that and then loop it back to, hey, guess what? It matters for life too. So, but for today, we have our very good friend. Many of you probably recognize her. She's one of us, and Diana Kelly. It's a pleasure to have you co-host this edition of Unusual Gatherings.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Yeah. So the formula is pretty easy. We have you helping us to co-host. You pick who the guest is on this show, and you also get the responsibility to introduce him. So for people that haven't seen him yet in that corner there, or that are actually listening to the podcast, who do we have there yet?
We have a very dear friend of mine, Adam Shostak. And I was so excited when you asked, you said the author that you'd like to speak to that you know, and I, Adam, as you know, was my first choice because he wrote the book on threat modeling. But I'm also, I have an interesting story of the way that Adam and I met was that, he knows, I tell this a lot. But I was actually headed, so I used to live in Boston, as did Adam, and I was headed out to the very first Black Hat, which was, what, 97? Was that it, Adam?
It was 1997, yeah.
1997, wow. And I'm sitting there, I'm all excited because I'd never been to a big security conference before, and I was like, well, no, sorry, I'd been to RSA, but I was really excited to go to Black Hat. And I'm sitting there, and we're waiting to board the plane, and I looked at, around the people on the gate, and I thought, I bet this person's going to Black Hat too. And it was Adam. And sure enough, he was one of the speakers there. And he said something that stuck in my mind forever, which is that when you're doing really good, when you're doing code reviews, can I say which company you were doing them for?
Sure, go for it.
So he was doing code reviews and helping with application security at Fidelity Investments. And he was doing a presentation on how to do code reviews on software, especially at firms that need to have, you know, high security. And I was like, yeah, I'm all listening. And I'm expecting him to say something, you know, really super technical that was going to be over my head. And he said, so one of the most important things to remember is bring donuts. And I was like, okay, I get it. And actually over the course of years, as I worked in application security, I realized that that was actually the best advice Adam could get. He gave a lot of technical content, but that piece of advice was the part.
You want to avoid problems. And if you don't have donuts, you have problems. So.
Well, there's so much there. I mean, you're connecting with the human, right? But yeah. All they can do is listen while they're chewing. And then they're pumped up with sugar, ready to go after you have that chat with them.
Exactly.
Perfect. Well, Adam, it's a pleasure to have you on. And I'm a geek and nerd, just like you. So and you, Adam. So I'm really going to appreciate this conversation. And maybe just a quick word for what you've been up to. Maybe
so
leading from Fidelity and to your
yeah, you know, it's interesting that Diana tells that story, because sort of full looping around, I've been just released a white paper a month or two ago now, which I call the Jenga view of threat modeling. And it's all about how we need technical skills, we need soft skills, and we need organizational discipline to make it work. And we like to talk a lot about the technical skills required, and we can go there if you'd like to go there. But if you don't surround the threat modeling activity with the stuff that the human beings need and the stuff that the organizations need to make it go, it doesn't take in the same way as if you bring donuts.
Or even makes gamification. Sense. I was wondering, if for people, listeners might not know that you started something called the EOP card game.
Yep.
And maybe talk a little bit about that. Oh, you've got that. Okay, great.
I got there this. You asked me to bring props, so I brought I brought props.
Nice.
So sure, the idea is that, or sort of the genesis is when I created the Microsoft threat modeling tool, it turned out to be a little on the tedious side. It turned out to take some of that sugar, that engagement out of the rum. And so I said, what is it that we can do that makes people engaged? And nothing gets people more excited than games. And so Elevation of Privilege is a card deck. Let me see if we can get this in focus. It's not going to focus, but you can, there's a card here. And I can't read the card because it's backwards, but I'll flip it around. And it says an attacker can write code to a data store your code relies on. And this is the six of tampering here. I think if I get behind the card, the camera's autofocus picks up on something other than my face. And so the idea is you have these hints, and I would deal out the cards to each of you. We'd be sitting around a table. The cards are big. We get the laptops out of the way, and we tell people this is a game. We're going to have fun. We're going to improvise. We're going to engage with the questions. And because each of you has a card in front of you, you can't avoid engaging a little bit. And you've got a hint right here that shows you what it is you might do in this round. And so it's turned out, beginner's luck here. I hadn't actually designed any games before this, and everything just sort of came together in a way that's, you know, I feel really grateful that it worked out so well.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, and was really cool. Was that part of the inspiration as you wrote out because you did the card game before the book, right?
Yes.
Before your book. Was that part of the inspiration to write the book, or how did you get inspired to write the book on threat modeling?
Were you inspired? Were you inspired?
You really didn't want to do it.
My history of writing books is that the book becomes easier than not the book, which is a pretty high bar. And so the history behind, and here, look, I'll just wave it around. It's got a signed by the author thing on the front. It's a lie. I've never signed this.
At the end of the show, you will sign it.
At the end of the show, I will sign this, and I will dedicate it to the two of you, so that the copy that I wave around from here on will be dedicated to the three of you. Excuse me.
Perfect.
Yes. There you go.
But the idea was, and I'll give you a little history. I started threat modeling formally in the late 90s. I wrote a paper with Bruce Schneier, And then in 2006, I joined Microsoft and my boss said, hey, Adam, can you fix this threat modeling thing? I was like, what do you mean? And he said, I don't know. Step one is to figure it out. Step two is to convince me. And step three, will we go do it? I'm like, okay, cool, scary, cool. I'll go with cool. And so over a couple of years, I had this amazing opportunity to deep dive into threat modeling, to talk to a huge number of really smart people about their experiences trying to threat model and trying to make it work. And after about 4 years of doing this, I realized that I knew so much about the topic, that I had learned so much, even though I'd been doing it for a few years, doing it all day, every day. There was so much going on in my head that the simplest thing to do was to write a book. That writing would force me to organize it. It would force me to clarify it. And it would give me a way to answer the questions that people had, which was, please read chapter 6. It has everything I know about this topic.
And Adam, threat modeling, there's two ways I can look at it. And I want to get your perspective on this. There's threats that can happen to a business, and then there's threats that can happen within a system, right? That then ultimately hits the business. Does the book cover both, or is it specifically around building secure systems that have gone through an SSDLC? Or is it more the response?
Mostly about building secure systems, technological systems in particular. Okay. And part of that is there exists a whole discipline of business risk management that focuses in, you know, a big bank I work with thinks about 7 risks. They've got credit risk, they've got market risk, they've got liquidity risk, they've got geopolitical. And so at the board level, at the CEO level, we know how to think about these risks. And at the technological level, it's much more difficult. It's trickier. And you know, at the beginning, Marco, you were talking about you make a cup of coffee. And in pre-pandemic times, I like to say you can't walk down the street without threat modeling the idiot driving a car. Are they gonna stop at the stop sign, or are they playing with their cell phone and they're gonna drive right through and hit you? You're threat modeling. When we bring that to the technological realm, the intuitions that we learn as children, right? You watch parents with their children, they teach the children, you can't walk across the street, you have to look both ways. We learn these things as we grow up. We don't learn to look for repudiation attacks. We don't learn to look for how an attacker is going to persist once they break into this system. And so there was a need for making that knowledge systematic and available to folks.
And it really makes sense, because many times we're human. Let's go back there, as we always do. And technology is created by us, should be created for us to benefit from it. And so that's the business, that's the everyday life, that's the interaction with other people, that's society in general. So, but again, you get to the point and you're like, well, how am I going to apply this to a software, to a technological piece? It's not just by magic that this is not going to have the problem, because it's designed by us. So how do you do that translation in a way that is comprehensible and applicable?
So I like to start with 4 key questions. What are we working on? What can go wrong? What are we going to do about it? And did we do a good job? And if you think about it for a second, these actually have nothing to do with technology. You can apply them anywhere, which is, to your point, how do we introduce this, right? How do we get people thinking about this? And no one can really object to those questions. right? If we're working on a piece of software together and I'm the security person and you're the product manager, and you say, Adam, I don't care about what can go wrong, you're going to feel a little silly, right? And so we can just ask those questions. We can answer the question of what are we working on at a whiteboard. We can leave the question of what can go wrong at that super high level. Or we can start to use tools, right? We can start to use these structures that add specificity, that adds rules, like a data flow diagram has five elements, or we might use the stride mnemonic to help us think about what can go wrong. We might use bugs as a way to track what are we going to do about it. And so we can go from this super high level thing, these four questions, into what's the best way to answer these questions. And it seems in some ways like a really small thing, but as I think about it, I think the four question framework is a useful advance to how we help people threat model. And it's a, I hate to call it an invention because it doesn't seem like an invention, but it was, as you said, it was a thing which we created. And we can think about, and we can think about improving it. You know, I'll give you an example of improving it. When I started, I would ask, what are you working on? And I've transitioned to asking, what are we working on? It puts me on the same side of the table as the people I'm working with. What are we going to do about it includes me in solving the problems. It's not the security person coming in saying, ha ha, that sucks, and leaving the room. Right? It's what are we working on? So,
and Adam, who are some of the we's? I don't know if you can share any stories of and any cool projects you were involved with that the team maybe hesitated in the beginning and then really rallied and came together and produced some really good results.
Yeah, so, it's easiest for me to talk about Microsoft, which I left in 2016. I'll slip Diana notes so she can say things on their behalf now.
I know, we just missed each other at Microsoft.
We did. So Microsoft was amazing for me because my bosses all looked at me and said, this is not competitive advantage. Please go share everything. Right. And so Windows, Office, and Dave LeBlanc and I actually had some fairly public fights on our various blogs over, he had a blog post titled Threat Modeling the Bold Button is Boring. Because the guidance that we were giving at the time was threat model every feature. And so there was a requirement that somebody who was working on the bold button go threat model it. And, Dave was right. Threat modeling the bold button is boring. And it was an artifact of Microsoft's very bottom-up program managers, developers lead and drive what a team is doing. And today, my response to what Dave would say is, there's no interesting trust boundaries. There's no new data coming in or out. Excuse me. So our answer to what can go wrong doesn't need to be a stride per element exercise. It can be, we've got no data crossing these boundaries. We're done. Our threat model was super lightweight for that feature. And let's focus our attention. And this is where we ended up. Was let's focus our attention on an overall view of Office and say, where is the data coming in? What can go wrong on that attack surface? And it turns out that in threat modeling that, we discovered that the way in which various data coming in was being parsed was somewhat inconsistent, and this is a long time ago. But we were able to improve the consistency of the parsers and the consistency of the defenses that happened as various Office products took in data via threat modeling. And so, yeah, there was this very public argument, followed by some great conversation focused on what do we do to improve the value that we get from the effort we're putting into this work.
You know, Adam, one of the things I hear a lot about threat modeling is it's too much work. It's boring, you know, and with something like, okay, the bold button, that's one small aspect. But looking at this move, the shift left, DevSecOps, how do you see threat modeling fit in with this very rapid push and deployment? And how would you recommend companies think about integrating threat modeling in a very shift left kind of mindset?
So two key things. One is the question is, what are we working on? And if what we're working on is the bold button, our threat model doesn't need to be complicated. If what we're working on is a new integration with some cloud provider that's going to send files to us in a new way, what can go wrong is a lot bigger and a lot more complex, so we better spend some more time on it. Mm-hmm. So that's one key part, is focus on what you're doing right now. The second key part is threat modeling, like any other skill you're developing, is a journey. You don't go to the gym and lift 250 pounds. You don't start cooking and learn how to make a souffle. You start cooking and you learn how to boil water. If you go and you try and use something like stride per element on day one of your threat modeling as a way to answer the question, what can go wrong? It feels big, it feels overwhelming, but you can build the skill to get there and pull out that tool from your toolbox when it's appropriate and reasonable for the scale of problem that you're having.
And Adam, quickly, I know Marco wants to jump in, but just a quick question on if you go too complex and too deep, do you run the risk of coming out with the wrong answer of what could go wrong?
One of the things, these are actually the words that open the book. All models are wrong and some models are useful. George Box, a British statistician, said that. And what he means is when you make a model, you're abstracting stuff away. It's going to be wrong. And so when you ask, do you run the risk of it being wrong? No, you run the certainty of it being wrong. But I like to evaluate, is it useful, right? And so when you say, do I find the wrong threats? Do I go too deep? Well, if you're finding threats that you're fixing, that's an improvement over not threat modeling at all. And maybe it's an opportunity to develop more skills to focus your work in a different area. But the idea that we're getting the wrong stuff out of this and therefore we should stop, and that's normally the next step, really frustrates me, because we go through this learning journey and skill development takes time.
Yeah. So it makes me think that this threat modeling is really, in the end, common sense. Sorry if I break it down like that, but in the end, that's what it is. And it's kind of like, you know, can you prevent bad things from happen? Probably not, but I can't work on make it less likely to happen. And I'm actually, Diana, here, I'm quoting Steve Katz that we interviewed not too long ago. I mean, this is the core of these things. And I feel like I bring it back to common sense, where yes, if, as you say, Adam, if you teach the kids to watch on both sides of the street when you cross the street, it's common sense. You may not see everything anyway, but you minimize the risk And if then you look on both sides of the street, is that one is a one-way street, and you're paying even more attention, right? So my point is, with this concept in mind, how do you see very relevant, important industries out there, talking like, you know, aerospace, I'm talking infrastructure, I'm talking a lot of these things that use software, use technology, but they use many other things too. So how do you apply your concept that seems to me very, you know, makes sense to this bigger complexity that you can see out there everywhere around us?
So the first thing we do is teach the skills, right? How do we answer these questions? What are the structured ways of answering these questions? Like, again, data flow diagrams, stride, kill chain, things like this. And we teach those skills to people in the industry doing the work. And then we talk about overlaying and combining these skills to the way they're delivering things. I'll give you an example, and this is public, so it's something I can talk about. Next week, with the FDA and the Medical Device Innovation Consortium, we're teaching 60 medical device manufacturers about these skills. We're doing a class that would have been a two-day boot camp in person. We're doing it over the course of 5 days in a distributed way. And so we're bringing these folks in. We're bringing in the device makers. We're bringing in the FDA reviewers who regulate the devices. And we're bringing in some experts in threat modeling, including myself, to develop the skills and then have a conversation about what does the threat modeling work look like in the medical device record. And we're really looking at this as a conversation. I'll give you an example. At a conference last fall, someone came up to me and said, is threat modeling a noun or a verb?
Yeah.
Right? And what he wanted to know, and what I want to know, and what a lot of people in this field want to know, is which matters more, the activity that we're doing or the record that we keep? And my hope is that we're focused on making sure the activity is done well, and that we can find ways to incidentally create records that will be good enough, because what we want to avoid is a paper pushing exercise. So let me bring that back to your question, which is how do we do this in big complex systems? Is we say, look, there's these four simple questions. You know how to build, say, medical devices that are safe and effective. You know how to build automobiles that meet the safety guidelines that are out there. How do we overlay this cybersecurity thinking in a way that is structured, systematic, comprehensive into what you do so you can continue shipping products that satisfy your customers, you can continue innovating, and you can avoid making mistakes that make me as a cybersecurity person go, what did you just do?
I'm wondering, like, expanding that, even thinking about threat modeling outside of the technical realm. So something like, we're all in the midst of a pandemic right now around the globe. And, you know, is there an application to threat modeling in very complex systems that don't necessarily have only a technical component?
So, you know, it's super tempting to say when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I want to say this with respect to the public health officials who are really finding themselves in a weirdly unexpected version of a pandemic, right? They knew a pandemic could come. They did not expect the response to a pandemic to be politicized. and to have to deal with aggressive disinformation campaigns. So, you know, please wear a mask. It's good for you. It's good for the people around you.
And you look great, Adam.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I didn't even realize that my mask and my shirt sort of matched.
They paired up well today. Exactly.
And again, it's common sense.
It is. It's common sense. And, you know, maybe if they had undergone a threat modeling exercise, they could have said, wow, there's this disinformation risk that's happening. And we can look at the way that platforms like Facebook and Twitter and TikTok are being used for information operations by professionals in the 2016 election. You know, I'll be honest. If you had asked me how the KGB would interfere with an election, I would have gone much more with the Manchurian candidate approach than I would with, we'll use Twitter to get Americans to yell at each other and not vote. But we can absolutely think about bringing these tools and techniques to bear. And one of the things that I've been playing with is, what are the equivalents of, what are the ways in which we ask what can go wrong in these online systems, right? We know that images, we know trolling, we know, and by images, I mean images being used to inflame, doctored images, copyright infringement, right? There's a set of ways we can think about what can go wrong, which centers on the fact that we've got an image here. I spent a little time talking to the folks at the OpenAI Institute about GPT-2. What can go wrong when your tool is infinite amounts of reasonably convincing human-like text? Well, it turns out you can use that to flood the channel with more nonsense than a human being can respond to. Right. And so we can think about bringing these tools to bear on conflict. And, you know, I would love for folks to take a look at what I've got on GitHub at GitHub Adam Shostak conflict modeling and to contribute. I'm playing with these ideas. I'm talking to some folks about these ideas, about how do we make them real. And simultaneously, super aware of the risk that everything, when you all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so I want to make sure that I don't say this is the solution to everything.
You haven't built the solution for world peace?
I do not have a solution for world peace.
Okay. In there, you just have to find it. So Adam, as you take a drink, you kind of started that segment, if you will, with the concept of a conversation, and you ended up with conflict and from the pandemic level, you mentioned misinformation. And I'm wondering, you can't have a conversation and expect it all to go well. So there will be conflict. So how do you address that in this? And it's probably not out of the realm of reality that there might be misinformation as well. If somebody within the business wants to see that product release, perhaps there's a campaign to suggest everything is fine, right? Get that product out. So how do you address that as well? So the misinformation and the conflict as part of the model and the engagement.
So engagement is a key word. The thing you see on Twitter or Facebook or even LinkedIn is not the thing you have asked for, right? If I subscribe to each of your Twitter feeds, Twitter will show me some number of your posts under its top tweets view. And what they're doing is they are looking for engagement. And I don't mean to, I mean to pick a little bit on Twitter, but all of the companies do this, right? They are looking for engagement. And what is engagement? Engagement is replies. Engagement is argument. Right? We don't respond to happy, fun stuff the same way we reply to, let me tell that idiot how wrong they are. And so I believe fundamentally that these platforms are profiting from a design that encourages conflict, because it brings you back to say, let me respond to that idiot once more and tell them off. And so I believe that there are designs that we could engage in. For example, and when I say we, I mean society, right? There have been experiments with, we're not going to show how many likes a post gets, I think, on Instagram. As a society, we could choose to, say, ban TikTok. We could choose to tax the like button, right? If every time the like button or the retweet button was used, Facebook had to pay a penny, they would redesign the heck out of it so that the conversations we have are more organic. Google could choose to remove some of its insane recency bias from their search engine results. They could choose to not have every YouTube search result in Alex Jones after 3 clicks. But Alex Jones is engaging, right? And the reason that we get to these problems is because these companies are engaged in a bit of a Red Queen race, I'll explain that, to capture and keep your attention so they can show ads. And a Red Queen race comes from Alice in Wonderland. You have to run faster and faster just to stay in place. When Facebook adds 6 different versions of the like button, LinkedIn follows, because otherwise LinkedIn loses to this new engagement model that Facebook has. All of these companies that engage in getting us to doom scroll are engaged in a very real business competition in which we and our emotions are the product. And as long as we, and, you know, I want to be really careful here. I don't mean to blame the human beings who are being manipulated by the psychology departments of these companies. I don't wish to blame the human beings who are being manipulated by the A-B testing, which is causing them to discover smarter and smarter new ways. I don't even want to blame the psychologists who work at these companies. Everyone's incentives are aligned towards a race to the bottom. And once you hit bottom, it's a lot, the race is who can get the most shovels.
Yeah. I was gonna say, there's only way but up. You just painted a different picture.
and so I really think, and you know, I'm not a fan of saying we need government intervention, but I really don't see these problems solving themselves through self-regulation. These problems might be more solvable if we mandated that platforms allow a variety of clients. You know, I like to joke that I'm using my ironic font in Slack because Slack won't even let me choose a font to use. Twitter used to have a variety of clients, right? And from that variety of clients, we saw innovation, including the creation of the doom scroll, right? The automatic scrolling was an invention in a Twitter client. And all of the platforms insist on controlling the user experience, which means we can't have human-centered defensive innovation. So maybe one innovation is tax the like, one response is tax the like button. Another might be to require open interoperability of, we can get our own Slack client, our own Facebook client, our own Twitter client. Gosh, think about this crazy thought for a moment. Why do I need a separate tab for each of those? Right? Why can't I have a social client which obeys the rules that I give my user agent, pulling in some old technical jargon there, and pulls down the content that I want to see, like an RSS reader, and makes it available to me in the way that I want to see it. I went on for a while there. Thank you for the soapbox.
But you sure get us thinking. I don't know, yeah. Diana, what are you thinking? Then I'll tell you what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, it's a couple of things. One is just the psychology that we go through because we, you know, and that we get caught in. You know, we've seen that ML skews towards bias, humans skew toward bias. So I was thinking as you were talking of Jessica Coker, who is a person who does wildlife rehabilitation with foxes. So if you want to find her, she's under Juniper Fox on social media, because Juniper was her first rehabilitated. And she, a couple of months ago, posted on Instagram, I'm going to start to try and teach people more about wildlife rehabilitation, because she'd gone to social initially to teach about wildlife rehabilitation. But what she was finding was that the click where Juniper had the little sparkles in her eyes and looked like the most beautiful fox in the world was getting tons of love, and where she's talking about, hey, this is the downside. Like at one point, I remember reading something about like the smell of the foxes, which it had something about like you turn in the driveway and you can start to you know, smell a fox. And I was like, oh, wow, you know, that's really interesting, because she had set out to do this very good thing. But over the course of time, the clicks, the likes were driving her more towards the sort of fantasy. So that was one of them, is that we as human beings sort of need, we want to do the right thing, but sometimes these social tools, we start seeing even ourselves, so they're in no malintent. The other thing that was coming to mind was, as you're talking about, can we use an RSS feed to show us what we want? I think about a lot of early on, after the internet was starting to get picked up, some of the big complaints were, well, we're choosing the feeds that we see, so we're almost narrowing our view. It used to be that when all we had was the way back, all we had was the newspaper coming out of the newspaper, you know, box or delivered on your doorstep, you kind of had to page through. Mm-hmm. And the newspaper worked really hard to be, you know, fairly in the center and be representative. Now, some of what happens with these RSS feeds is that we can kind of feed to us only the stories that we want to hear. And as you're talking about, I was thinking about, yeah, how do we address this? How do we get people to look, read things that maybe they're not as interested in the way that we used to with the newspaper, or even way back in the day when it was, you had 30 minutes of national news a night, you heard those stories, not just the stories you wanted to hear.
It's a very good point, but even back in the days where you had less options, there was still somebody on a lower level feeding you the information that they wanted to feed you. It wasn't like the whole information in the world in a very objective way, you know, like you will have the politic orientation of a magazine or a newspaper or even a TV. When I was studying political science, the first rule was, you want to hear the right news, you get three newspaper. One is from the left, one is from the right, and one is some kind of a public press where you make up your mind. And the problem here is with social media is that, like everything else, it starts with why. And it starts with, what's your bottom line? If your bottom line is to get advertiser, or is a political agenda, or is whatever it is, you're going to try to manipulate. And the bottom line also is, we've always done that. Except that now the power that we have, it's incredible. It's out of control. So that's where maybe threat modeling could really come into place.
I was thinking that, you know, if when you were designing Twitter, if you could start thinking what could go wrong, I suspect nobody would have threat modeled out, possibly a U.S. presidential campaign could be partially influenced. I don't think that that would have been one of the, I definitely wouldn't have gone down that path.
Yeah. Look, it's my lunch. And by the way, Vladimir Putin over here.
Right, yeah.
It really comes back to what Adam said, like, here's the shovel, just keep digging. Right. But how are we going to stop this?
Let's bring out the shovel, because I mean, what I'm curious your view on the future and the canopy.
Yeah.
What you said, Marco, can we stop this? What are we stopping first is the question. But I mean, we're talking about manipulating the mind, but in parallel, we're also creating a physical world that's developed by humans with sensors and devices and a whole set of smart cities are coming, right? That will control effectively people physically in addition to controlling their mind through things like social media. So what's the future hold in that regard? And what do you see? Is it something we have to stop, or is it something we can change and control in our own way?
Take your time.
Yeah, yes, is the answer.
you know, I think, so I live not far from the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone here in Seattle. And let me tell you, what I saw on the news media was not the peaceful scene that I saw when I physically visited it. And what I see today is we actually have architectures of control, right? When you talk about the smart city is in a sense an interesting upgrade to the conflict we're seeing in a lot of cities between citizens wanting to protest, some people choosing to protest violently, and the police response. And a lot of, you know, I've seen a lot of videos that seem to show fairly unprovoked violence. Is it an improvement to have the technological system doing that enforcement in a less violent way? Or does the scaling out of that enforcement cause a different set of problems and injustices? You know, as looking around the table here, we've got four people. I'm guessing we're all reasonably well off. We can afford a lawyer. The police are less likely to engage in violence against us. Do we make some of this invisible in the way, you know, there was a book entitled The New Jim Crow, which was all about the social structures of control that have become invisible in our society. And so I don't have answers to these questions, but I think it's important that we ask who benefits, what are we working on, and what are we building? You know, we don't have one thing that we're building at any given time. We, you know, living in a dynamic world, lots of people are building lots of things. And I have a piece that I can usefully add to, let's make sure those pieces don't have really glaringly obvious problems, which is an improvement. And we have to have these bigger conversations.
I love it. And maybe as we come to a close here, unfortunately, Diana, maybe you could bring it home for us, and perhaps the answer is threat modeling, but the question still remains, who's going to do it?
So, yeah, Yeah, I think you're absolutely, you know, you're right. It's and Adam, very well taken. You know, when you've got a hammer, it looks like every problem is a nail. But I do think that when you expand the concept of threat modeling to really be risk evaluation and risk assessment, and if we could all step back and understand in very complex interdependent systems, there are unintended consequences when one aspect of that goes wrong. There's also, if we don't think about the variety of potential downsides, we do get, you know, surprises. I think we were all, you know, fairly surprised about these troll farms actually influencing, you know, you put it really well, Adam, with, you know, troll farms getting Americans to scream at each other, you know, other nation state trolls, you know, getting us in the U.S. to fight with each other because separation can be, you know, divide and conquer. I think that if we could take a threat modeling, a risk assessment approach to things that are not technical, to things like society and understanding it, these are complex interdependent systems, in addition to that, that maybe we can start to think out a little bit more clearly how things that we introduce into society and how we prepare for big unexpected crises, you know, we may be better off in the long run. But it's going to be a challenge. And Adam, I love the thing I loved the most about what you were saying was that these four kind of high level questions that bring it to a we that are very non attack, not like, oh, I know the thing you're about to build is going to mess things up. If we could apply that to society and think about as we integrate new technologies, as we start doing our interactions with each other in very, very different ways, as we've seen with social media, maybe, you know, that'll help us to at least, and nothing's ever going to be perfect, but maybe we can get a slightly better, more informed approach going forward than where a lot of people end up. Sometimes we introduce new technology, we're like, gee whiz, this is super cool. And then a couple of years later, we're like, oh, I didn't think of that.
I didn't think of that. I think like the more variables you add to the model, the more hard it is to foreseen what is going to happen. So when you talk society and you talk people, human psychology, I'm not saying that threat modeling a software is easy, but I think that if you have an enclosed environment, a controlled environment, you can think it a little bit better. And then when you blow it up outside of that, it's complicated. So I agree. There is not an answer, but we can get better at it.
Could I just add one very quick thing before you close us out, Sean?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You close.
No, bring donuts. Believe the people around you have good intent. I've said some slightly mean things about some of the social media companies. I don't believe the people working there have bad intent. I would bring donuts if I were to sit down with them.
Good point.
Vegan donuts.
Vegan donuts.
And with that...
With that, I'd say bring donuts as well, but I'd like to think that we're more important than the old button. And I assure you, solving the threat model for us as a society is not going to be boring. I want to thank you, Diana, for co-hosting the session. Adam, fabulous to catch up with you and get your insights on all this stuff.
Thank you.
And clearly... we all have a good read ahead of us in your threat modeling book, so everybody take a look at that. And Marco, another story.
Nothing.
We keep marching along this unusual journey.
So. And we start somewhere. We don't know where we go, and I just usually love where we end up. So, good guest. Yep. Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Adam. Take care, everybody.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this conversation. If you learned something new and this story made you think, then share ITSP Magazine with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our columns. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.